Well, good afternoon to everyone. It certainly is a pleasure to be back in Cleveland once again. It's wonderful to hear so many good memories, the flawless piano playing of Mr. Mark Graham again. My wife whispered, she said, "Can we get him to play during the sermon time instead of your sermon?" She didn't say it, she was thinking it, I know. I was too. Can we make that just happen for another 45 minutes or so? No, it was just beautiful to hear that, to be back and to see so many familiar faces and good friends. And I thank Mr. Thomas for giving me the opportunity to speak this afternoon. It's really exciting as well to see the growth that's happened here at Cleveland. We had just met Larry and his daughter at the feast in San Diego, and hearing him up here for a sermonette and just seeing there's life, there's things that are happening here. God has blessed this congregation, the hall you have now to meet in. What a wonderful thing. I know there's many churches that would love to be in a spot like this. So I know it's been years of toil and different things have happened, but God has certainly put his favor here, and it's great to see the wonderful things that are happening in Cleveland. So we have, we'll always have a special spot in our hearts for Cleveland. Both our children were born here, and some of you did not recognize them. It's been 13 years. I had to wait for the statute of limitations on the mortgage to clear up before we could come back to town, but I think we're okay now. I get a little giddy when these camera guys are around, though, too. I have no comment. That's all I say, no comment, right? But it's been too long, so we'll try to get through a little more frequently because we love coming through. We're actually going back to Buffalo tonight to see my mom. My mom still lives there. She's doing great. Get back to Buffalo and spend some time with her as well. But hopefully we've met some of the new people, newer people. You've been here a little for a while, which is great, but hopefully we'll meet a few more of you after services as well. But it's really exciting to see what God is doing in this congregation. Well, this afternoon I want to ask you a question. Are you familiar with the movie or the book Unbroken? Most people? Nobody? I think we're past, like, what do they call it, the spoiler alert? So I'll tell you a little bit about what happens there. Unbroken basically is the bio of a World War II hero that is shot down during combat. He survives 47 days on a raft in the middle of the ocean, which is unthinkable to begin with that could happen. And then he's captured when he thinks it's Americans, but it's not. He's captured by the Japanese, and he spends 2.5 very, very difficult years, almost unimaginable years, in 3 different Japanese camps, and he survives all that. And he lives, I think he died at about age 98, several years back. It's an incredible story. It's an incredible book, and it's an incredible movie that was put out recently. But I think about that sometimes, and I feel quite insignificant when I think of my life, my situations. There are certain days when I look at what's going on, I think if I had to write my book or my movie, it'd probably be called Broken, right? And when I think about certain days and how I feel, I just think, boy, I just can't even deal with what's happening. And I go back to a story about 4 summers ago. There was a gentleman, a group, organized this trip to the Boundary Waters. Many of you are probably familiar with the Boundary Waters, in between up by Minnesota and Canada. It's supposed to be a lovely father and son outing. There were 4 fathers, 4 sons, 8 went in. I think 7 came out, but it was, no, all 8 of us came out. But it was this trip where we went up, and it was supposed to be a nice little leisurely, we'll canoe out for about 2 hours, set up base camp. I was promised there'd be so much fish, we'd be throwing them back in. All this stuff was going to happen. Well, we got there, we paddled for about 9 hours. It rained. We got to our spot. We barely got to a spot. It was getting dark around 9 o'clock. We put our tents down, and we hit the mother load of all the mosquitoes up in that area. Finally got our tent set up. We got inside. I'm still ribbed about this 4 years later. I didn't pack very well. So we slipped into our sleeping bags, literally. It was all wet. This was a father and son bonding moment. My son Luke turns, "Dad, why did we do this? This is not real fun." And at that point, if it had rained the next day, I was broken. I really felt I couldn't do anymore because everything was wet. It was miserable. We were tired. My son was not happy. But luckily, the sun came out as it did today, and we were able to make it through, put our stuff out, air all our stuff out, and start over. But it's true in life sometimes how quickly you can feel fragile, how quickly you can feel vulnerable, how quickly you can feel beaten down. You know, and sometimes I think about, well, you know what? It's not just us. Isn't that the story of what we read in the Bible? It's interesting when you read about Job, right? Job, who was so greatly blessed for God for many reasons. When things turned on Job, and I think it's interesting, what did his wife say to him, right? "Curse God and die. Be done with it. Isn't it funny? I think a little quick side note, his wife is not mentioned by name, right? But she's the one that tells him, just curse God, be done with it, right? And then the story of Elijah, I think, is utterly amazing in 1 Kings 18. We've read that before, where all those prophets of Baal, there were 450 prophets, and Elijah's having fun, and it's, okay, who are you going to choose, Israel? Is it the Baals, or are you going to choose God? And he goes, let's go up to a mountain, let's just build, put wood into a big fire pit with no fire, and let's see if your gods or my God can bring down fire, right? We know that story. And he mocks them, and they're yelling for their gods, and nothing's happening. He says, why don't you just cry aloud? Maybe they're on a journey. Maybe they're doing business. Maybe they're sleeping. Right? He's having fun with them, right? We know what an unbelievable thing God does, and he calls down fire, and he wipes out and kills those 450 prophets of Baal. Where do we find Elijah the next day? Because Jezebel says, I'm going to do the same thing to you or my life. He's in a cave hiding, and he says, God, it's enough already. End it. Take my life. I'm not as good as my father. It is enough. Right? Don't we have those days when we feel that way, where it's enough? We can't take anymore. We can't do anymore. We sometimes feel broken. Right? Have you been there? I don't hope, but you'll relate a little better to what I'm saying. But I have had days like that where you feel you can't do anymore. You feel broken down by the process. You know, that's the story of mankind. And I want to look at something back in Exodus this afternoon of a similar situation, hopefully just draw a couple lessons from that story to our lives today in this 2016. Turn back with, if you would, to Exodus, the 17th chapter. Exodus 17. You know, I have a lot of empathy when we talk about the Israelites and all the things they didn't learn, because I know how I react in a lot of situations, like I told you with that boundary water trip. You know, it's amazing within a matter of hours how quickly you can feel disconnected from God. You can start to grumble. You can start to figure out, why am I in this spot? Is it going to change? What's going on? Well, that was the story of the Israelites as they came out. We're not going to go there, but if you look at when they first left Egypt in Exodus 15, they had bitter water. They couldn't drink the water. In Exodus 16, they had no food. They're also in the wilderness of sin, which I find to be sort of foreshadowing as well. In Exodus 17, they come, and now there's no water, right? So it's been a difficult start to a trip. Have you gone on a trip, and it's hard, and things aren't starting out the right way, and you forget something, you got to turn around, and, you know, this is a start of a, this trip is not starting out all that great. We read this, right? And you go to Exodus 17, and look at verse 2. Exodus 17, it says, therefore, there was no water. In verse 2, the people contended with Moses, saying, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And Moses there goes back to God and says, what am I going to do with these people? They're ready to stone me. Now there's no water to drink. And God intervenes and tells Moses to strike the rock, and they find water. Look at it in verse 7. And so he called the name of the place Massah, in Meribah, because of the contention of the people of Israel, because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Isn't that how you feel? Unfortunately, sometimes we can feel that way sometimes. Is God involved with what I'm going through or not? Does God know this? Where is God? Right? It's an easy, sometimes, mindset even for us to get into. God, where are you? Is God with us? In verse 7, is God among us or not? That's sort of the backdrop of where we find Israel, right? So you can take that situation, you can take your own personal situation, I can take my situation, that's life, right? That's the difficulty of where it is. But see where they're at? I can identify, unfortunately, with that mindset. God, are you among us? God, do you understand? God, how long is this going to go on? God, do you hear what's happening? God, do you see? God, are you among us? Do you understand what is happening here? That's the story against the backdrop here. In verse 8, so all this stuff is going on, and now Amalek comes and fought with Israel in Rephidim. Amalek now, on top of all this, we just get a little bit of water, and now battle's going to start. Rephidim, in the Hebrew, means resting place. A resting place, right? Doesn't it feel sometimes you just want to go to a spot, and you want to get to a resting place, and it's all calm? And then another battle starts again. You know, you think, not again, not again. Amalek comes to fight against Israel. So it's against this backdrop I want to look at what happens and draw some lessons from verses 9 through 15. Let's just read verses 9 through 15 here briefly. Verse 9. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy because... So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and the people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." So what do we learn from this? This little short account back in Exodus for us today, sitting here in Cleveland in 2016. Well, the first thing I would mention is that we also, like Israel, are under attack. I appreciated the sermonette. It is so true because we are at war. We are at war. There are so many things that are happening. We also find ourselves under attack. We read about Amalek here. Who was Amalek in the Bible? Amalek was the grandson of Isaac. Long history with Israel. It even says Haman. Haman was of the line of Amalek. The Amalekites haunted Israel for a long time in their history. All right? And this was one of these skirmishes. But they had a very, very organized agenda for how they attacked Israel. Look at what Moses said before they go into the promised land about Amalek. Turn to Deuteronomy. We'll just look at this one verse. Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy is really the second reading of the law, and Moses is recounting a lot of things for the children of Israel before they go into the promised land. In the midst of this chapter 25, in verse 17, he mentions this. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you were coming out of Egypt." This is years later. Moses is mentioning this. "How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God has given to you to possess, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget." How were they attacked? Did Amalek attack from the front, their best warriors? Did they meet them head on in an open field? No. Scragglers, the tired, the weak, the weary. Sound familiar? That's how we're attacked. We are under attack today, and it's a very orchestrated, well-planned agenda. When we look at how we're attacked, when we look at how things are working in the world today, that our weaknesses, our vulnerabilities are under attack. There was a very good article in the Beyond Today magazine by Charles Mallier. If you haven't read it, I would encourage you to read it. It was some time back about the agenda, how an agenda is passed through, the five steps of bringing something to pass, where you bring a little bit, you move someone a little bit further, you get them to accept this, before you know it, I've accepted something I thought I could never accept. Does it sound familiar? Sound familiar in the mid-90s, and it sounds familiar in our society today with some of the things that are happening from a moral compass and perspective in our society. I talk with my wife sometimes, and I think, you know, it's difficult for kids growing up today in the church because it was always hard. I talked with a gentleman before church because of the Sabbath and the things that are difficult. But you felt in society in general with your other friends and people you knew and your neighbors, you had the same general moral ethical beliefs. Well, now in society, that's even gone. There's even a gulf, a divide with what we would call basic beliefs. Basic things are not accepted. You know, our children see that. My daughter sees that at school sometimes. Basic things that you would think would be accepted by 14, 15, 16-year-olds, they're not valued the same way. you know, we know the moral compass is being lost. There's an agenda that's being pushed very, very, very strongly. So even though we're tired, the attack keeps coming. It's a very, very concentrated agenda that is around us in society. I think about the announcement bulletin we heard with sickness and different things that happen. We hear of sickness that can also challenge our trust in God. God, where are you with this situation, with what's happening, with this difficulty, with this trial that continues to go? We are under attack. I think about any number of trials can challenge our patience in God's will. God, how much longer will that happen? And I mentioned this permissive moral atmosphere can even make us challenge our spiritual wherewithal or our discipline, and can also move us a little bit in what we believe is right or wrong. There certainly is an attack that's in place. But this was all in the fine print when we signed up at baptism. You may not have read all the way down, but it said this is how life was going to be. It wasn't going to be a rosy, easy path. But I appreciated the sermonette because we all, and I think we do, recognize that there is a battle. There is a very conscious battle that's underway. There is an agenda that's in place. It is Satan looking to divide, as we heard, to discourage, to devalue things that God has held in his word. And it's there coming at us every day, and it can easily seep into our lives, into the church as well. So that was the encouraging part of the sermon. No. So given that backdrop, and you're like, wow, this guy is great. You're glad you brought him out today. But we are under attack, but God has called us to be saved and be victorious. So how does that happen? What's the good answer? Because you saw a victory for Israel. There was victory in this situation. God wants us to have that same victory. How is that accomplished? Let me give you three points for the remainder of the sermon that we can just talk about. And how is that done? How is victory accomplished? What I would say the first thing we see from this little passage is, number one, God wants us to put our allegiance and our reliance on him. Totally. Now, that sounds so easy, right? We all say this for a number of years. God's word is not rocket science. It's not difficult concepts. Pretty basic, but hard to really do. When I think about putting total reliance and allegiance on God, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. If it weren't, we'd all have bounds and bounds of faith, and we'd be in a great spot, and just storms and waves would hit us, and we would just stand there, and no worries, no problems. But it's a day-to-day coming back and reaffirming that. Who's central character in this story? Moses. Let's go back to Exodus 4 and look at Moses. Look what happened with Moses in terms of Moses having to replace his reliance on God. Moses, who was a shepherd, and we all have crafts and tools of our trade. For Moses, it would have been his rod or his staff. You can imagine how many times Moses just used that as a part of his workplace. For some, it could be, for us, what? It's the computer, right? For most people, it's the computer. It could be your toolbox. It could be anything that you have just used years and years. That's what Moses would have had. And look what God says in this situation. When God is starting to deal with Moses in terms of bringing Moses from a point of reliance on himself to reliance and allegiance on God. Moses, because it's sort of a comical back and forth with God and Moses when God is telling Moses he wants him to go before Pharaoh. And you can imagine the daunting task, and Moses is coming up with a number of excuses. Well, what if they don't believe me? And later, I'm not a good speaker. What should I do? And maybe it won't work out. And every time, God is saying, no, here's what's going to happen. So we get that in Exodus 4. Moses said, but suppose, God, they don't believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. Right? He's looking for an out, which is natural. And the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. And then the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. And he reached out his hand, and he caught it and became a rod in his hand. It's an interesting thing what God asked him to do, but he had to sort of throw that down, get himself out of the way. And when he picked it back up, he realized that rod was something different. Now, God was involved. God was in command. Look at verse 20 of that same chapter. Look at verse 20. Then Moses took his wife and his sons, and he set them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. No longer his rod, no longer something he just used. Now it's the rod of God that's in his hands. Now it's something that symbolizes God. Now it's God's will be done with that rod. Now it's Moses getting out of the way and stepping back, and God says, I'm going to take control. I'm going to give you something with that rod that's going to do some amazing things. You could do a study on the rod in the Old Testament. You see what that rod, how that symbolized God when he struck the rock, or he held up that rod and they parted the Red Sea. And we'll see the rod here again in the story we're reading about in Exodus 17. All of a sudden now, it's not reliance on me. It's not doubting God. It's not wondering where God is. It's not coming up with my own solutions. But now it's stepping back and putting full reliance in that rod of God. Changing our mindset to step out of the way and saying, God, I want to rely fully. And that, boy, that's hard on certain days, isn't it? It's difficult on certain days when we think we've got a solution that can short-circuit that. I laugh sometimes. I've told this story myself before, but you guys haven't heard it. When I get into those spots and I'm figuring out my solution and doing everything, and I'm at a spot where I'm just tied in knots, my wife will say, have you prayed about that? Right? Step one. Right? Some basic things you forget because we humanly want to go to a spot and I want to have my solution. Like Moses is trying to figure it out. Well, how about this? How about this? He says, no. Here's how we're going to do it, right? Here's how we're going to do it. Imagine if we step back out of the way and let God take over. Let God take charge. One of my favorite comedians, on a quick side note, he had died recently, John Panette. He's a funny comedian. I really like his style and his delivery. He's a heavy guy, so he made fun of food and his weight and appetite, but he would talk sometimes about people being in line. You know, he had no patience because he wanted to eat. And he's like, Kentucky Fried Chicken. What do they have? People would say. He goes, they have chicken. All right? They have chicken. Get out of the line. You know? So if he were talking about this, he would just say, get out of the way. Right? Get out of the way. Let God step in. Again, easy words to say, but sometimes very, very difficult for us on a day-to-day basis to do that. But victory is assured when we step back and we say, God, I've beaten my head. I've been up too many nights. I want to step aside and I want to try your approach. I want to rely on you. I want to put reliance, dependence, total allegiance over to you. Right? If you notice with Moses, once that switched and that was the rod of God, that's when we went back. God, what should I do? What's the plan? What are we doing? Right? So what happens in Exodus 17 when Amalek is there? And now it's like, hey, it's time to fight now. God, what are we doing? Right? Moses basically becomes an instrument in God's hands. I like the fact that now at this point in Moses' life, he's an older man. He goes to the top of the hill, and he's going to hold up that rod. And they're going to wait for God to bring some deliverance. Isn't that hard sometimes? It's easy for us to read an account because we know the happy ending. We don't know sometimes a happy ending in our life as we're going through it. We don't have the end of the story where we go, wow. Phew. And people tell you sometimes, you're going, oh, no, it'll all work out, right? It'll be fine. It's going to work out. But when you're going through that, that's hard to step back and say, I'm going to stand here because God says do this. For whatever it is, we heard in the sermon about the Sabbath, or whatever difficulty, whatever situation, you got to stand for a principle. And you wait on God, and you take those waves and those storms. It's hard at the time, right? But here's Moses goes up to the top of the mountain, and he holds that rod up there, that rod that symbolizes God, and saying, you know what? We're putting our trust, our allegiance in God. That's where we're going to put it. That's where we're going to trust. And you look in verse 11 and verse 12, what it says in the account back in Exodus 17. Exodus 17, so it was when Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But his hands became heavy, so they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it, and they supported his hands, and his hands were steady to the going of the sun. I think it's interesting. Moses could have gone up there and just held on to the rod, but holding that rod up, what does it do? It forces even the people on the battlefield, even the Amalekites would see that rod. They would look and say, you know what? God's presence. That's what they wanted the army to see, to look up, to see that, to have total reliance, dependence on God. That's step one in God assuring us victory. that as we walk through these difficulties, that we constantly point our back to God in prayer and study and reliance on Him as part of that victory. What's the second thing that happens in this account to assure victory? Well, they got involved. They got involved in the fight. If you notice what happened, what did Moses say to Joshua? Joshua, in verse 9, he said, "Choose us some men and go and fight with Amalek." This is the first time we hear of Joshua. Hadn't heard of Joshua before this. But if you notice, he says, "Joshua, you go out to the battlefield. Aaron and Hur, come with me," right? Everyone had something to do. Everyone hopped in, and there was unity. It wasn't like Joshua said, "I'd rather go up in the hill. Could I hold your hands up and maybe send one of those guys into the battlefield?" No, everyone had their assignment. There was unity. That's something I think is such a hallmark of God's people over the years, and I'm sure it's still here as well, where there's unity, where there's people getting involved. We heard about even for the camp, people doing things, getting into the fight, helping out where you can. You know, so easy for all of us sometimes to say, "Well, what can I do? You know, what can I do to help out? What can I do to help a situation?" But you see here, there's so many different things, so many different things that can be done. I think about Aaron and Hur holding up his hands. And sometimes I thought, you know, you think about our ministry. Do I do enough to hold up the hands of those in charge, to support them, to pray for them? So many things we can do, right, as a body, as a group, to help out. But sometimes things, it's scary, right? It's really scary. A couple of years ago, we went to, I think it was up in Toronto, where they have those glass floors when you're really high up on a bridge. And they have some now, I think, in the Grand Canyon that goes out, I think it's 100 feet, and it's all glass bottom. All right? I used to be a lot braver with heights. I painted water towers when I was about 17. They were 200 feet up. Now I have a hard time changing a light at our home if it's like more than 2 feet up. But you walk out on those things, and I have videos of people, if you want a good laugh, watch people trying to walk out on those things, and they're being dragged. It's scary. Right? It's really scary to take that first step sometime. It's really scary to go out there and put ourselves out. You know, but sometimes it's just taking that first step to get involved in the fight. It could be here when you come to church and just extending the hand of friendship. That's scary sometimes because you don't know how people will react. But it's just part of that as well. Also, it can be just taking even situations like I hear people talk about, even opportunities like sometimes when you come for an opportunity like this, sometimes I think of even giving a sermon or speaking. Sometimes you wonder, what do I have to say? Sometimes, is it going to be worthwhile? What do we, you know, it's, and you feel sometimes it's difficult, but then you get up and you start speaking, you ask God for help, and you feel and you pray that you have something that's worthwhile. But sometimes it's just taking that first step, right? Like they say, you can't walk on water till you step out of the boat, right? That's why sometimes we say, "God, I pray, give me courage to be part of someone who gets involved in the fight, someone who promotes unity, someone who wants to be part of that army we heard about, that will step and engage and be involved." God has called us to be involved in that battle, in that victory. And that's what we see here in this account. Prayer and unity equals victory. Victory. Imagine when Moses was up there as well, when he was holding that rod, I'm sure he was praying to God. Prayer is never a bad way to get engaged in the victory. Well, let's look at the last thing that's here as well in this account. And I think it's something we have to do all the time. Remember that God is our banner. We'll read that in verse 15. There's an interesting sequence here. In verse 14, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.'" That word banner comes from the Hebrew Nissi. And you'll see sometimes in the King James, Jehovah Nissi. It basically means a banner or a pole or something that's conspicuous as a signal or to raise as a beacon. It means God is this light that's flashing on the horizon. He's a beacon. He's a standard bearer. That God is the one that we look to. And it's easy things. These are not like, again, difficult concepts that I'm bringing forth this afternoon. But it's more of remembering when we get into that spot when the winds are swirling and the waves are crashing, of where we look and where our deliverance comes from. I think back to this time of year when we see a lot with flags. We see flags even last night at the opening ceremony. There were all the nations bring their flags. And what I noticed as we were driving from India as well, I see a lot of American flags on the highway now, the more of them where they have those memorial markers for on the highway, and you see a flag draped underneath it. It is just a good and solid reminder when you see today we were driving, there was a flag up above the freeway just by itself in the middle of the overpass, just the American flag, right? And when you see that, that just brings back and it stirs feelings of freedom and liberty and courage and all the things we espouse as a nation. And that's what Moses is saying here. He says, the Lord God, that's what God is saying, I am your banner. I am the beacon on the hill where victory comes from. That's what he's saying. I think it's very interesting here where he says, write it for a memorial. And that's where they made an altar there at the end. They made an altar and they wrote it for a memorial so they wouldn't forget. I've done it. I don't have it here with me, but I have a little journal I keep, and I don't do a great job of it. But I think it's a very powerful thing because sometimes, at least I do this, you get through a trial, you get through a hurdle, and you're like, God, thank you so much. And then you go on, and you're back to the next battle, and you go, God, where are you? At least that's the way my mind operates. And I think, you know what? There were 6, 7, 8, 9, 26, 35 things I could have written down where God has come and delivered. And said, I am your banner. I am the one who brings deliverance. Some of you probably remember when our daughter was born here at the hospital in Cleveland. It was a difficult time for us. It was a very, very difficult time. And I know the Grahams remember well, and we appreciated so many prayers, but there were times when it was teetering to a very difficult spot in the road, and then God showed his hand, and it was powerful. And you think back and, you know, you remember some things where God has delivered in a big and a powerful way. And that's what Moses said, write down, make a memorial. Don't forget. Don't forget. Because unfortunately, too often, we get to spots and all that becomes blurred and we say, boy, I'm on my own out here now. I really feel like I'm on my own. God, where are you? He said, make a memorial of it. And I also think it's interesting where he said, say it in the hearing of Joshua. He says, recount it in the hearing of Joshua. Make sure he hears this. You go tell him that I am going to settle the score with Amalek. That I am the God. I will not forget. I laugh at that sometimes because I heard about Numbers and I missed this. I need to listen to this accounting sermon because I would have liked to have heard that. But I deal with numbers sometimes, and sometimes I am such a natural scorekeeper, and it's annoying sometimes. I keep track of everything. So no, the score is 4-2, not 3-2. You know, so it's something that's in the back of my brain. But then God says, don't worry. I'm keeping score. I've got it handled. You don't have to worry about keeping the score, right? I am the God who knows what's happened. I am the God. Vengeance is mine. Those are powerful things for us to remember. It says, make sure Joshua knows that. You tell him that because he's going to be the one that's going to go into the promised land. He's going to deal with them. And let him know that I will be the one that will take care of that situation. And I think how awesome, how powerful is it? I had a situation a couple weeks ago where I was talking to a lady in our local congregation. And she was telling me about a situation where God had intervened in a family situation. And how encouraging it was, and we shared different things, and we came away very encouraged because we had shared something. We had shared where God and his power had intervened mightily in our lives. It's a powerful thing to exchange that. Again, I appreciated the comments in the sermonette about that. When we share those things as a family, as a body, and we remember where our deliverance comes from. Because we live in a world now that wants us to think anything but that. That our deliverance becomes on our own reasoning, our own science, our own ability, our own thought process. that we can figure it out, and we see how effective or ineffective that solution has been or is becoming by the day. It's important for us to remember that. That's a marker that God said, make sure he understands that. Make sure he gets that message. Make sure we give that message to each other as well, where we have powerful things, where God is doing wonderful things, where God has given us deliverance, that we share that, that we make a memorial about that. So God says, I am your banner. Like I said, I think of our banner. I think of the U.S. flag. I think of the Star Spangled Banner written by, I'm sure Mr. Graham would know, Francis Scott Key. It was during the War of 1812 as they were defending Fort McHenry. And it was written because through all the bombing, through all the things that were going on, there was hope because that flag was still in the background. Maybe it was tattered or torn, but it was still there. It was still visible. It was still present. It meant there was still hope. There was still something that could come that was going to be good. I'll just read that. Star Spangled Banner. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight over the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave. Every time I hear that song, this gets me very, very excited, because not only is the game going to start in a few minutes, but the words are powerful. They convey fortitude and hope and promise and liberty and so many wonderful things. But that's just, as we know, physical. We're just a country and a nation, and that's something that's here today. But God says, look to me as your banner that will always be there, that will always be permanent. And like I said, I sort of chose this topic because I think back to, as time goes on and the years roll by, and I think about, like, the kids are here, and most people, a lot of them had a hard time even recognizing them, and so many difficult things have gone, and what we read in Exodus 17, 9, verse 15, that story of Israel, if we all had six verses, we could pop our own story in there, right, over the years. And we keep up with the Cleveland family, believe me, and the difficulties and the trials and the struggles and the good things that are happening. And we look at that and we're encouraged because we know that God is the one we look to. God is the one that we put our trust and our reliance and our hope and our faith in every day, and we come here and there's a body of people who are doing the same thing. In spite of difficulties, in spite of a world that pushes back pretty hard against that, in spite of a world that has an agenda that wants to separate us and believe that that's not the path forward, that's not the answer, that there are people that are still doing that, looking to God and standing firm every day. Again, it sounds like a simple thing, but I know it's a challenge. It's a difficult thing, and sometimes we can say, like they said in verse 7, is God among us? God, are you hearing this? God, are you seeing this? Are you feeling what I'm feeling? This is difficult. But we stand, we go forward, we're involved in the fight. There's so many good things that are being done, I know locally and with God's people, that it's encouraging to see that, to come and to see people who are now hearing about God's message because of that work that's being done. And not to forget that our reliance is in that banner that won't go away, that beacon on the hill, that light that's there. Like God said, and God said, you know what, make a memorial. Write it down. Sear it in your mind. Share it with each other. Because that's where our true hope and our confidence and our reliance is in God, who truly is our banner.